Coming up on the broadcast, as always on a Friday, the past 5 days in this economy of ours from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, 13 January. Glad you're here, as always, everybody. A week out from Inauguration Day, and arguably the biggest changes coming to this economy in 8 years, so we are going to get right to it. Felix Salmon, is it Fusion Lee Gallagher? Is it Fortune Magazine? They are both, I think, right, in our studios in New York. Hey, everybody.
We're together.
There
yes,
you
we
go.
Are.
All
Hi,
right,
Kai.
That's good. All right, so Felix, test my proposition there. Would you, the biggest changes to this economy in 8 years, agree, disagree?
Probably in 80 years, to be honest. This is seismic. This is certainly an end to gridlock. This is when everything which hasn't happened for basically living memory is going to start happening. It's almost impossible to overstate how big it is when you get all three branches of government basically aligned with each other with a mandate to really change things a lot.
Lee, you buying that?
I mean, I agree. Yes, it's hard to understate what's going on.
So let me actually, Lee, continue with you then with this. Robert Costa had a great piece in the Washington Post this afternoon in which he pointed out that Mr. Trump, for all his desire for a high-impact, high-velocity administration, will run screechingly into the gears of Congress, and it is going to slow things down. What do you make of that?
Meeting with the nominations?
Well, not just nominations, but his infrastructure plan and all the things that he has said he's going to do in this economy.
It building depends. The wall. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he's got both houses, so it's not – I don't know if I totally agree with that.
And what's more, it works the other way as well, that the House and Senate, the Congress, is going to pass a whole bunch of laws – from a Republican Congress. There's no way that Donald Trump is going to veto those laws.
Oh, no,
so the
of course not.
Laws are going to all get passed, you know, whether they're technically the Trump agenda or technically the Paul Ryan agenda. Either way, it's going to be a huge change.
Yeah, I just think there's no comparison to the obstructionist era that we're just coming out of.
Right.
None.
Okay. All right, fair enough. I heard a phrase yesterday. I mentioned it briefly on the broadcast. I want to run it by you guys. Trump tweet risk. This idea that American companies now, and I saw a great piece the other day, and I forget who wrote it. Companies in Silicon Valley have their public relations people getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning so that they can be on guard, Lee, for tweets from the president-elect about their company.
Unbelievable. I think this is just like maybe as big as all the changes that we just outlined a few minutes ago. I mean, I think this is just companies are it's almost like a sniper type situation. But although today, or was it today, we saw the opposite where Trump came out and endorsed L.L. Bean and said, buy these products.
Right.
And so then you have a sort of almost Kardashian-like impact the other way. So
I'm going to come out and say this is a non-story.
Seriously?
The man's making economic
policy 140 characters at a time.
The Trump Twitter account is this weird, shiny object that the press corps cannot tear its eyes from. And every tweet creates a whole bunch of stories. He'll tweet about Toyota or whoever. What? And then, like a knee-jerking, the press will say, oh, my God, Toyota stock plunged. But when you look closely, it plunged by 0.2%. Most of the time, there's
not always. Not always.
But. Yeah, I mean, so Felix, I grant your point that it is a bright, shiny object, and one should always, when looking at his tweets, think about what the object of distraction is. But the man is making economic policy on his Twitter account. Do you disagree with that?
Yes, I disagree with that. I think he has a crazy stream of consciousness Twitter account, which is not economic policy. Economic policy is going to be set by Congress and Treasury and all of these institutions which have ways of setting policy, and the tweets are a shiny distraction.
All right, fair enough. Spence, you mentioned Treasury, Felix. We've got a minute left. Steven Mnuchin, the nominee for Secretary of the Treasury, has his hearing next Thursday, the day before Inauguration Day. You get to sit and ask him a question. What's your question?
What qualifies you to hold one of the most important public offices in the land when all you've ever done your entire career is self-interested, making yourself rich?
Lee?
I would ask him to go back in time when the housing crisis was in full swing, and knowing what we know now, would he have, and if he were the head of IndyMac, which he later acquired, would he behave the same way and make the same loans that the company did?
No doubt he gets confirmed, right? I mean, just to stipulate that.
I think there's little doubt.
All
right. Yeah.
All right. Fair enough. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon at Fusion. Have a nice weekend, everybody. Oh, wait. Okay. You know what, Lee? I almost forgot. I wrote myself a note. New book coming out, right? The Airbnb
New
story?
Book coming out.
Yes. Plugs the book.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
What's
Thank
it called?
Thank you so much. It's called The Airbnb Story.
There you go.
So how three ordinary guys disrupted an industry, created millions, and created plenty of enemies. Made millions, created plenty of enemies. Got to get used to that.
Got to get used to
saying
that. You got to get that right, man. Come on. All right.
Coming out in a couple weeks. Thanks
so much,
Have a
nice weekend, everybody. We'll see you. Bye-bye. On Wall Street today, the Trump bounce has deflated just a tad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. I didn't get to it with Lee and Felix, but bank earnings came out this morning. BAFO would be one word you might use. Profits jumped because of all the trading that happened the past 3 months. But as with all things, devil details. If you look down at the line items where margins on interest rates were reported, profits were flat or only slightly higher, which is weird because isn't the Federal Reserve raising interest rates? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what's going on there.
One measure of how banks are doing is net interest margin. It's the difference between what banks earn in interest on loans, mortgages, stuff like that, minus how much interest they pay to their customers with, say, savings accounts. Robert Hartwig is a professor of finance at the University of South Carolina.
It used to be the case prior to the crisis that banks were able to maintain a reasonably strong margin between the lending rate and the rate that they paid depositors.
When interest rates dropped to nearly zero, banks had less wiggle room. Now, with interest rates rising, why hasn't the net interest rate margin improved?
You really wouldn't expect it yet.
Michael Johannes teaches finance at Columbia University. He says a big reason is existing loans.
If you're a large bank like Bank of America with, you know, more than $1 trillion in assets, most of that is already committed loans. And you know, it's only the new loans that they're going to be making will be at a higher interest rate.
Keep in mind, interest rates only started inching up toward the end of last year. Tim Courtney from Exential Wealth Advisors says banks should begin to see the benefits in 2017.
We should start to see improvement within, say, 2 to 3 quarters.
He says investors have been optimistic, too.
The bank stocks did very, very well in anticipation of these margins growing.
And maybe also in anticipation of more rate hikes this year. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This morning, the Environmental Protection Agency announced a decision not all that popular with either the automobile industry or supporters of the incoming Republican majorities in Washington. The EPA locked in strict fuel efficiency standards first put in place 4 years ago, standards that are going to oblige automakers to more than double their mileage by 2025. Marketplace's Adam Ellington has that story.
As part of a 2012 directive, EPA had until next year to decide whether the fuel efficiency target of more than 50 miles per gallon was doable. Well, they decided, and the answer is yes, a ruling which would add significant costs for car makers.
The main objection is feasibility.
William Yateman is a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a libertarian think tank. He says the regulations would make cars more expensive precisely at a time when fuel efficiency isn't a big selling point.
Consumer preferences are largely dictated by the price of gasoline, and as such, we've seen consumers flock to these SUVs and trucks and the bigger cars.
But the regulations don't, in fact, mean that every vehicle must meet the same target, so says Brandon Shutley of the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute.
But everyone has to get a little better, so that's where still, even though you have maybe some slightly different goals with a truck or SUV than a small car, all of them have to get better.
Shutley says spending more on R&D doesn't mean car makers can't make money, just maybe not as much as before.
All of that adds up to each of these vehicles ultimately being a little less profitable, especially if they have to make this happen sooner rather than later.
Investing in fuel-efficient technology is ultimately a good strategy, says Tony Dutzik, a policy analyst with the Frontier Group, a D.C.-based environmental think tank.
We have a long history of oil prices and gasoline prices whipsawing back and forth. You know, and I think that the public understands that.
Because of the way the EPA ruling is structured, it would be very difficult for the Trump administration to undo and would likely result in lawsuits from environmental groups. I'm Adam Ellington for Marketplace.
A lot of cities in this country, big and not so big, have been trying for decades to fight urban blight and the poverty and the crime that typically come with it. In St. Louis, on the predominantly African-American north side of town, they haven't had much success in doing that, so the city is trying something new. Rather than turn land over to developers so that they can build on it a block at a time, the city is handing an entire neighborhood over to an agency of the federal government. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams went to North St. Louis to get a sense of what is coming and what is being lost.
Darren Spencer had delayed as long as he could. Now it was time to go. So on this rainy morning, his cousins and nephews moved remaining boxes and bags out of his home in the neighborhood where Spencer had lived for decades and where both of his parents died last year.
My mom and my dad, they loved the, holidays, cook dinners and stuff like that, and barbecue. This was a happy home, you know.
But now, it was one of the few occupied houses in a sea of vacant lots and buildings to be leveled, all to make way for the new western campus of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. The agency uses satellites and scientists to collect data for defense agencies and first responders, among others. For Spencer, it meant leaving his home, but he says his family got a better price for it than they might have otherwise.
We had to move. At least they're paying you.
They is the city of St. Louis, which gave the land to the NGA and is spending more than $50 million to move people like Spencer out of the way of the $1.7 billion development. More than 20 city blocks, thousands of employees.
So we're looking at about close to 100 acres of landscape on the north side of St. Louis.
Susan Pullman is the director of the NGA's program office here.
Where we're standing right now is pretty close to where our main operations building will be located once we do our construction and move in.
Demolition has already started, and construction is expected to create hundreds of jobs each year for several years and spur a wave of retail and housing development outside the gated facility. Todd Swanstrom at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, studies big urban development projects. He says this approach has potential, but it's a risky strategy.
This idea that you can, you know, have one big project which is going to transform a city, generally the answer is no.
The NGA isn't promising any new jobs once the facility is complete. The 3,000 or so people who work at the old site will simply be moved across town.
The question for NGA is whether it will spin off benefits to the community, or will it be a kind of self-contained thing that was literally dropped in the middle of one of the poorest areas here in the St. Louis metropolitan area and doesn't interact with the fabric of the city.
This project has been extremely controversial here, displacing a historically black community with a gated-off government agency, but the deal is done now. And walking through the future site, the NGA's Pullman says she's sensitive to the concerns.
Today, NGA doesn't look like this community, but I would say we certainly are making every effort to broaden the diversity of our workforce as time goes on.
She says the agency is already working with local schools and colleges, offering internships and other initiatives to interest students in math and technology. I asked Darren Spencer how he thinks people in the surrounding neighborhoods might benefit.
They might get a job, you know, help build it or something like that, but maybe younger kids that's in college or something like that, they might get a job there.
Spencer does think the city will benefit overall, and there's actually little precedent for a government development project like this. So many are taking a wait-and-see approach, even the NGA's Pullman.
We're not the end-all be-all, but maybe we're a spark, and a spark that's enough to make this neighborhood and its residents proud.
The project is expected to be complete in the early 2020s. In St. Louis, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Coming up.
There is a lot of worry. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of sadness.
Personal finance and the Trump administration straight ahead. But first, sure, why not? It's Friday. Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave up less than a 10% today. 5 points, closed at 19,885. Did the blue chips. The NASDAQ advanced 0.4%, about 25 points there, 5573. That's another record, should you be keeping track. The S&P 500 picked up about a 10%, 4 points, ended things at 2274. For the week, the Dow shaved off 0.4%. The NASDAQ added 1%. The S&P 500 shed 0.1%. So banks, as I mentioned, reported today. Wall Street was pleased. J.P. Morgan Chase moved up 0.5%. Bank of America banked 0.3%. Even Wells Fargo, which came in below expectations, rose more than 1.4%. That right there, that'd be a bet on the future. Healthcare kind of mixed today. Aetna unloaded 0.25%. United Health slid about 0.3%. Cigna, though, up more than 1%. The NASDAQ record close I mentioned up top. Facebook can take a bow for that. Facebook jumped 1.3% today after an analyst upgrade. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody. Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you, too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show, too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Big week next week in the global economy. Not the inauguration, although, as Felix and Lee were saying, that is a big economic deal. I speak here of the World Economic Forum, the gathering in Davos, Switzerland, of the political and financial elite. Usually, it's a celebration of globalization and free trade. This, though, has been no ordinary year on that front, not just here, but in Europe as well, what with Brexit. So we asked Marketplace's Stephen Beard to find out whether the bigwigs are going to be chastened at all.
Good afternoon and a very cordial welcome to everybody.
Klaus Schwab, founder of the world's most expensive gathering, welcomed the media to his mountaintop retreat this week with this little icebreaker.
Every market economy will produce winners and losers.
There'll be rather more winners among the 3,000 or so people attending this year's bash, whose theme is responsive and responsible leadership.
The system will only be sustainable if there is enough solidarity between the winners and the losers.
Schwab says he wasn't surprised by the backlash from those left behind. Davos has been warning of it for years. But economics commentator Louise Cooper says it's hard for the forum to talk about this properly without more of the losers taking part.
We have a discussion entitled Squeezed and Angry, How to Fix the Middle Class Crisis. Great, that's the kind of thing we need. Guess who is on the panel for that? The multi-billionaire hedge fund manager Ray Dalio.
Of course, having billions doesn't mean you don't have a social conscience or good ideas, but, says Cooper,
it would be more realistic if some of the people speaking were actually those at the bottom of the food chain rather than those at the top.
So will it be business as usual at Davos? Not exactly. This year, for the first time ever, a Chinese president will attend. And, says Professor Kerry Brown of King's College London, Xi Jinping will project himself as the champion of globalization at a time when many fear the US is about to abandon that role.
I think we're going to see a China that is more globally responsible, has more status, because of the space that America will be freeing up.
China will reaffirm its support for free trade, but, says Nariman Berevesh of IHS Market, expect a lot of fine words in Davos, but don't expect China to act the way the US has in the past.
What the US did for decades was run big trade deficits, and in so doing, propelled the global economy. The question is China willing to do that? I'm not so convinced.
But is Mr. Xi going to feel ill at ease hobnobbing with Western plutocrats in a wealthy Swiss ski resort? Not a bit of it, says Kerry Brown. The Chinese will love all the attention.
Everyone wants Chinese money now, and so this delegation are going to probably be the highest status one there. So they'll be surrounded by people who will be really flattering them and making a lot of fuss about them being there.
And there you have it, says Davos skeptic Louise Cooper. The secret of the forum's enduring success, money, power and flattery.
I think it's an ego trip for those who rock up and are given a podium to speak to the most powerful people on the planet. And I think that's the reason why it will never disappear.
She says the global banking elite almost crashed the world economy in the 2008 financial crisis. And if that didn't bring Davos down, nothing will. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One of the big personal finance priorities for the Obama White House has been a group of people collectively known as the unbanked, people who just don't have access to the financial system, usually low-income borrowers without traditional credit scores who've been helped by the Treasury Department and also nonprofit groups in getting microloans and building their credit histories. Those programs are called financial inclusion programs run by the nonprofits. And with Donald Trump's inauguration a week away, those groups are wondering how much things are going to change. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
19-year-old Roxana Mercado Rojo needed $700. She was brought to the U.S. from Bolivia as a toddler. She's undocumented and decided to apply for an Obama administration program that lets people like her get temporary protection from deportation and eligibility for a work permit. But there's a fee. Where to get the money?
You know, I couldn't kind of borrow from my parents, and, you know, there wasn't anyone of trust that I can borrow from.
Mercado Rojo thought her only choice was a payday loan. Then she heard about a nonprofit called Good Fund. It loans money to people who can't borrow from a bank. Mercado Rojo got the money and a job in the process. Now she works for Good Fund as a counselor for people like her. She says undocumented immigrants avoid banks because they worry they'll be turned in to immigration authorities.
But I think through like banks and institutions and, you know, anyone that could have your kind of your information, I think there's a certain type of fear.
The Treasury Department has worked closely with nonprofits like Good Fund, which use government grants to make loans. And Treasury has held multiple forums over the years to help build up these programs. They're presided over by Secretary Jack Lew.
Good morning to everyone. Welcome to the Financial Inclusion Forum.
Lew was introduced at that forum by the guy in charge of Treasury's domestic financial inclusion programs. His name? Amias Garrity. Garrity says these programs are for anyone who can't get a bank loan because they don't have the credit cards and mortgages needed to build up credit scores. Garrity says Treasury has seeded money to nonprofits across the country, helping people in need.
I think the issues are not going away. The issues of how people access safe and affordable financial products and how they use the financial system to manage their economic challenges are not going away.
But what is going away is the Obama administration, which created these financial inclusion programs. So some of the nonprofits Treasury's worked with are worried that President-elect Trump won't pick up where President Obama leaves off.
There is a lot of worry. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of sadness.
Dara Duguay heads Credit Builders Alliance, which helps low and moderate income borrowers build strong credit scores. She says nonprofits worry that funding for government financial inclusion programs will be cut or the programs themselves will be eliminated entirely. Of course, it's early, and Trump hasn't even been sworn in yet. Duguay hopes that once in office, Trump will see financial inclusion as a way to help people who voted for him, who are struggling economically.
The issue of financial inclusion and helping people become more economically prosperous is one that crosses both party lines, so we do intend to reach out.
In fact, according to the credit rating agency Experian, 8 of the states with the lowest credit scores voted for Trump. I reached out to the incoming Trump administration for comment on financial inclusion, but it didn't respond. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, Twitter, the foreign exchange markets, and the president-elect. Bloomberg had the story. There's apparently a joke going around among traders in the Mexican peso that goes like this. Instead of spending billions in government reserves to prop up the peso, which has been getting clobbered since Election Day, as you might imagine, what the Mexican government ought to do is just use the money to buy Twitter and then shut it down. Think about it, right? No matter what Felix said. All right, on a Friday, we are out of here. The Dow gave up less than a tenth percent today, about 5 points. The NASDAQ up 0.4%, 25 points. The S&P 500 picked up a tenth percent. That is 4 points as well. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great stories next week. I'm going to be out. Great stories next week, though, from Erie, Pennsylvania. Check them out and have a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.